Coming up on this episode of the Leadership Lounge.
The difference between a head full of memories and a head full of regret is your ability to forgive yourself. And I think that encompasses a lot of what we just said, right? You know, to be an effective optimist, you have to be grounded in the belief that things can change, that emotions can change, that your effort matters. And if you're tethered to the past and you're unwilling to forgive yourself for a mistake you made, optimism is going to fall flat.
Welcome to Leadership Lounge. My name is Mitch Slater, Executive Director, UBS New York City, and I'm joined by my colleague, Saman Sami, First Vice President, Wealth Management from Dallas, Texas. And the best way to contact us is by emailing mitchslater@ubs.com or samansami@ubs.com. Our guest is not affiliated with UBS. Welcome to Leadership Lounge, powered by UBS. I'm Mitch Slater, alongside my co-host, Saman Sami. On this episode, we sit down with Case Kenny, entrepreneur, mindfulness expert, podcast host, and best-selling author whose work has inspired millions of people looking to live with more intention, optimism, and self-awareness. Case is the creator of the top-rated podcast, New Mindset, Who Dis?, where he explores relationships, mindset, leadership, and personal growth through honest and relatable conversations. He's also the author of several best-selling books, including That's Bold of You, I'll Be Honest, and his newest release focused on the power of optimism and the words we use to shape our lives. What makes Case especially interesting is that he doesn't approach optimism as blind positivity. He views it as something much more practical and powerful, the belief that things can change. And in today's world of uncertainty, pressure, and constant noise, that message resonates not only personally, but professionally. So in our conversation today, we discuss the connection between optimism and leadership, how successful people can stay ambitious without losing themselves in the process, why mindfulness matters in business, and why human connection may become even more valuable in the age of AI. We also talk about patience, identity, visibility, and the simple but powerful language shifts that can change how we think, lead, and live. Here is our conversation with Case Kenny.
Case, thank you so much for joining our Leadership Lounge podcast here at UBS. I want to start with the origin story. For people who know the content, but not the man behind it, how did it all begin? You studied language and linguistics, which isn't the traditional route into the space, but what pulled you towards understanding human behavior so deeply?
For sure. Well, thank you for having me, for one. Second, yeah, I mean, I'll keep it short and sweet. I think I owe a lot of my current passion and success, if you want to call it that, to kind of my upbringing, for one, and then my academic background, and then some life experience. So on the background side, I attended Waldorf school growing up, which is kind of a non-traditional way of learning. It's kind of a hippie thing, basically learn through play. And, you know, I went through that schooling up until like third or fourth grade or something like that. And I always appreciate that now, looking back, of, you know, I do something pretty non-traditional. And I teach people how to use words to create optimism, and I write and I travel and I advise and I do these things. It's somewhat non-traditional. And I always look back on that fondly as, you know, having sparked that creativity at such a young age and allowed for it to follow me into my, you know, late 30s at this point. And then, you know, I went to the University of Notre Dame, and I majored in languages. I majored in Chinese and Arabic. And that was seemingly, a somewhat non-traditional path. But, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, my brother went to Harvard as a cardiologist. My mom was a lawyer, big corporate lawyer in Chicago. And, you know, I felt the pressure to do something traditional. But, you know, I wasn't the most book smart person in the world, but I always had a thing for language. I was always good at language. I don't know if they teach Latin anymore in schooling, but I took 6 years of Latin. I took the AP twice and got fives. I was just good at it. It was just one of those things where I was just good at it. And I pursued those languages in college because I saw the application on international business or, you know, government work. So I saw the application there, but I just felt passionate about it and drawn to it. But then as life often does, it takes you in a different direction. I graduated. I ended up working in marketing and advertising technology sales for about 12 years in Chicago. And that, you know, offered me a lot of great perspective on life. I always joke that sales made a man out of me in like a good way, like the good kind of man, not the toxic man. It really just showed me that I could start at zero and build a business and build a sense of self. And it helped me build confidence and charisma and all these things. But somewhere along the way in 2018, when I was in my late 20s, I didn't really feel like I knew myself. Like I knew myself professionally. Like I had risen up from an account executive to a regional vice president. Like I knew what I needed to do. The blueprint was very clear. Make money, take clients out, you know, be a great professional leader, all these things, which is tremendously valuable. But I was frustrated by the fact that I didn't really know who Case was as a person, as a partner, as a friend, as a brother. And that frustrated me because I'm pretty type A and ambitious. I'm like, this is crazy. How am I a different version of myself in all these scenarios? I want to be the same version. So my solution to that was I started this podcast in 2018 called New Mindset Who Dis, where I would just riff on the things that I've learned and try to vocalize and force myself to have perspective. I'll say, I just need to tell myself that I have the perspective to make decisions for myself. So I don't need to emulate and copy other people. And long story short, the rest is kind of somewhat history there in that, you know, I've been doing that podcast for almost 9 years. That led me to write a couple of books. And really what I realized I was doing is I was using language to express myself. I was using my creativity to express myself. And then zoomed out, I was doing all of that because the thing that I've come so drawn to, which is helping myself be more optimistic in light of uncertainty, in light of ups and downs. And I realized that's what I've always been doing. And now, you know, many years having left that job and do this full time and several books written and many more to come. And now I travel the country teaching people how to use words to create optimism. You know, it's the thing that I'm meant to do. You talk about connecting the dots, looking back. This is the thing. I think, you know, you want to talk about the concept of ikigai, the thing that you're good at, you get paid for, that helps people. I've stumbled into it, and it's a beautiful thing. And I wake up every morning and I'm privileged to be able to do it. But it really just came from that frustration originally of not knowing myself and also being unfair to myself. And now I get to help people in a sense do the same in their life through words and through optimism.
In connecting the dots, I noticed in looking a little bit more behind you that we, I think, share an interest in Gary Vaynerchuk. I know you've done some work with these speakers. Gary's a friend. Gary happens to be a personal friend and client, known Gary for 15 years. The whole reason that I brought my firm into the 21st century of starting podcasts and videos while I was still an advisor before I took on the marketing role that I'm doing was because of Gary. And everything that I learned from him and the liquor store that his dad's liquor store that he turned around is like two blocks from me. So I grew up watching all of that happen. I just thought it was really interesting because I know optimism is something that Gary, you know, did talk about a little bit in his early days.
Yeah. Gary's got like aggressive optimism.
Right? Yeah,
he's the man.
He's the Red Bull of optimism.
It's a cool small world thing. I mean, because I used to, and I still do. I love Gary, and I know him personally now that I've done some work with him. But yeah, I remember very early on. You know, he wrote something when I was first starting out, where he said that one is better than zero when it comes to like speaking or posting or doing something, and that always stuck with me. And really, in the beginning, helped me find the motivation to post and speak, even if it was a small audience. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, listen, there's a lot of motivational noise in the world, and yours is obviously very intentional. So you talked a little bit about this, but why optimism, right? Like, when did you realize, like, this was really something worth building your life and your business and your speaking career and books about?
Yeah. Well, outside of the obvious, which is I think the world needs it. We're going through a tremendous amount of change.
More than ever, yeah.
As in every business sector and every element of humanity. I mean, I cannot think of a thing that's more needed right now as divisive as the world is. But then I also think of that I'm a very logical guy. You know, I've never been overly spiritual, although I do. That is an important part of kind of the foundation to the work. But I've always been like, if my brain doesn't believe this, my actions won't follow. I need something in my life that really clicks. And I think the way that I approach optimism, particularly within the definition of how I think about optimism, has helped that in that sense. That is, I define optimism as the belief that things can change. And I think that's really important because a lot of people, and I lead these sessions all over the US, and I usually ask people to start, what's your definition of optimism? And there's no wrong definition, of course, but most people say something to the extent of, you know, optimism is positivity. Optimism is the belief that everything's going to work out great. And I was like, yes, absolutely. I love that. Write that down, proclaim it from the mountains. But that's step two. Mm-hmm. Step one, the brain requires the belief that things can change. If you are in a certain circumstance and you want a different circumstance, what is the underlying logic of that transition and transformation? It's change. It's the belief that emotions aren't permanent. Your effort still matters. The future is subject to your effort. The dating pool can change. Politics can change. Banking can change. All these things can change, right? That has to underpin. And then the effort of optimism becomes so much simpler, right? I think sometimes optimism becomes so complicated. Well, what does the future look like? And how do I speak it into existence? And what is the goal? And all this specificity. Whereas optimism becomes very simple then. It's in the way that you speak to yourself. How can I always remind my head and my heart that change is possible? And then it becomes very simple. And it becomes a matter of linguistics, which we could talk about for sure. But I think that's so important because people right now in so many chapters of life are just convinced that things can't change, that because they've felt a certain way for a while, that that's it, because maybe they've stalled in their career, that they're done, because maybe they haven't found their calling, that they won't. Optimism is the wedge within that, that then helps align their belief with their identity and their identity with their actions so that they could actually change their future. So to me, it's a very logical process. And this is at the very, very base of changing your life transformation wise, just the belief that things can change.
Absolutely. So Case, I mean, I'm naturally an optimist and yeah. You are obviously an optimist. Yeah. And so is Mitch actually on this call, but nice. Some people just don't wake up being optimistic. Is this something you can train people? Is this something that can be taught? You know, you have the people that are glass half full and then you have the ones that are glass half empty. I think that's why they need someone like you. But is this something that can be taught?
It absolutely can be taught. And I'm not just saying that because I teach it.
Yeah.
I certainly am biased. But I mean, this is a measurable thing. I think people, there is a surprising amount of research, like decades of research, that really show that, you know, optimism as a topic, certainly you want to talk about topics like neuroplasticity and the brain and measurability. It's there. But you want to break it down even further to like linguistics, and all of the research supports this. It is, mm-hmm. I always say it's not a mood, it's a method. And for me, the method is word choice. And, you know, I have proven this in my own research. I've been in the lab in Miami, for instance, hooked up to all the nodes where I would take my brain through certain linguistic phrasing, and it is measurably different. And with the way that these brain scans work, you can't really fake it. These are like subconscious alpha, theta, gamma waves in your brain. You can't fake it. The brain literally does react to optimism. And in my sense, the mm-hmm. words that you use to reflect optimism. So absolutely. I mean, one of the longest run studies on optimism is the Harvard study, not the Harvard happiness study that everyone knows. There's another one that has to do with longevity, where they basically control for age, illness, activity, all these different things. And they showed that optimists on average, as they categorize optimists, add 6 to 8 years to their life, to their lifespan. So, I mean, this is measurable, not only mm-hmm. in its impact, but in your brain. And then most importantly, I mean, the whole effort of optimism isn't just belief. It's action. It's behavior. How can you get your brain to help motivate certain actions such that you can change your life, eat healthier, make better decisions, so on and so forth? So it's like it's a trickle down effect. And it, you know, certainly starts with that, and it absolutely is trainable. You know, and that's what I think I'm so passionate about. I've seen some people make tremendous changes in their life just based on word tweaks. And that's a trainable thing. And that's
what starts.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, your podcast, which I've really, really enjoyed over the years, and writing resonate with a lot of ambitious people. So I'm curious, do you think one of the biggest challenges with leadership today is that people don't know who they are without their title, success, or productivity?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a human nature. We look to validation to figure out who we are. And I think that's why I started my whole journey. I was like, I'm a regional vice president. And that just threw me for a loop because obviously that's not who I am as a human. I also think there's a tendency, particularly for ambitious type A people, to just lose the plot a little bit. And I always say that, you know, ambition without, I say mindfulness, but it would also be ambition without optimism inevitably leads to burnout. And so we need that wedge in there. Both, I think mindfulness and optimism are, you know, two sides of the same coin. Optimism is the belief that things can change. Mindfulness is the current that allows for that to be present in your life. I say mindfulness is the art of listening to yourself, but also talking to yourself. And I found sometimes that leaders lose that equation because they're so focused on what's next. They're so focused on the ambition. They're so focused on the KPI that listening to yourself is an afterthought. And that is where I have found a lot of leaders can really come back to themselves and practice a more mindful form of optimism that takes into account their ambitions, yes, but also their humanity. And then also, you know, on a more human side, my, you know, I'm very ambitious. I'm always hungry, insatiably almost. So, but you know, my fiance and I always have a saying that we say to each other anytime we're just getting wrapped up in the nonsense, which we say, life is for fun. Life is for fun. That's the point. It's not always for fun, but purpose is for fun. How can we get that back in the mix? How can we be more present with that in the mix? How can we minimize regret? So yeah, these are all interconnected topics, certainly, especially if, you know, you're a senior exec and you're looking back and you're like, man, well, life hasn't been so much for fun. It's always been for success. Optimism would say, well, you could change that, certainly. And same in the topic of like nostalgia. That's a big one. I find so many people are like, oh, the good old days. Like things used to be fun, but now they're not. Optimism would say, okay, well, you know, you have proof that at one point you had a good day and a good time and a fun life. Optimism would say you could recreate that. You simply need to do one thing, which is give yourself permission to be that person again. So again, all interconnected.
So what have you personally had to unlearn as your visibility and your success has grown?
Patience, unfortunately, which I think very acutely about this because we're probably reasonably impatient people here on this podcast.
Insatiable.
And I think it's a great quality of a leader and an entrepreneur and someone who's fast in business, right? I've always been the kind of guy to be sometimes to my detriment. I'm the kind of guy who's like, oh, let's just do it. We'll figure it out. Let's just do it. Let's commit to it. Let's do it. We'll figure it out. Served me very well in my corporate career. Has also served me very well now. I mean, I move quickly. It's also been painful sometimes, but I think the existential, you know, medium that has put me in sometimes has removed me from the presence of my life. And that's problematic. So really what I've done in lieu of knowing that you need to be patient in life, all the great things that are happening to me in my career right now, for instance, are the result of patience in the sense of I've planted a lot of little seeds over the years and now they're blooming 2-3 years later. It requires effort, but then it requires patience for that blooming season. And what I've done is I've stopped telling myself to be patient because that word will never work with me. It just won't. Patience, it's like an ick word for me. It's like patient, passive, absolutely not. So what I've done is I've reframed patience to faith. Have more faith in yourself. If you have faith in yourself, then you could wait a little bit. You could wait a little bit while the rain comes down and those roots grow and they're about to bloom. So for me, it's, you know, in light of wanting to be present in my life and not always thinking about what's next, I say, just have faith. You're doing the right thing. Have faith. You could allow yourself to be present now, knowing that your effort is going to pay off. Just have faith in yourself. If people have religious beliefs, have faith in a higher power. But I like that reframing for myself, moving from patience, which just doesn't sit well.
Right.
Maybe there's more to uncover there with the therapist or something. But for me, it's more of a faith element.
I'm also, I can tell you're very consistent. You know, one of the things when people ask me, like, why wealth management? Because I'm profoundly passionate about it and I'm consistent about it. Do you think consistency has a lot to do with optimistic people?
I think it's a core tenet.
Like the core, I was about to say that.
That is your superpower, Sammy. It's also mine. I mean, I've never missed a podcast. I do twice a week for almost 8 years and I've had a lot of ups and downs. I've never missed it because I love it. I think if you love something, it doesn't become something you have to do. It's something you just do, something you get to do. So, but I think, yes, on the optimism side, the whole purpose of optimism is to put yourself in what's called an anticipatory state. That's where the brain, it's defined in the definition, it's where the brain anticipates good things, or more specifically, it anticipates that things can change. So it's like, the most effective optimists, their default is optimism. They don't have to force optimism. It just becomes the way that they default to explain life. Martin Seligman, who's really kind of like the founding father of optimism, called this explanatory style, when something happens to you, what is your default explanatory style about that thing? And this is purely trained through consistency. A lot of people, their default is this thing that happened to me is permanent. A lot of people, this thing that happened to me is pervasive. It happens every single time. A lot of people say this thing is personal. I was personally targeted by this thing that happened to me, right? Those are the three P's. Those are pessimistic explanatory styles.
Mm-hmm.
Side of that, just reverse them would be the optimistic explanatory style. This thing is not permanent. This thing is not just about me. There's other people in the same boat. And just because it happened in this situation doesn't mean it'll happen in that situation. When that becomes your default, optimism is clean. It's beautiful. It's your default. And that comes purely through training, purely through many different, you know, psychological mechanisms, self-distancing from your emotions, pausing from your emotions, word choice within reflecting on your emotions.
It's interesting.
Let me challenge the concept just a little bit. Can optimism become dangerous? So for instance, in business, blind optimism, sometimes whatever you want to call it, can lead to a bad hire, a poor decision, a missed red flag. Like, how should leaders balance optimism with realism?
For sure. So they are one and the same. I think it's mm-hmm. a really important point. So I appreciate bringing it up. I think, a lot of people, again, to my opening point, I think, well, optimism is just positivity. It's just believing that everything's going to be fine. So let's just move. A core tenet, and this is proved both anecdotally through history, which maybe I can share, but also deeply rooted in the psychology, is effective optimism requires a 50-50 balance of realism and that hope.
Mm.
Absolutely. Every single time. All the research supports, you know, a lot of people want to be just delusionally optimistic about the vision. Oh, we're going to do this, that, and the other. A lot of people on the flip side are too realistic. All they focus on are the obstacles and the things in the way. The better mix is both of those in combination, vision and obstacles, but the order really, really matters there. All the research says the order, it's like PEMDAS with math, the order matters. First, it's vision, then it's obstacles, right? So first you have to give into the vision mm-hmm. and then you face the obstacles, not the other way around. And I think now that this group here might really get that, but a lot of people reverse that. They're like, well, the responsible thing to do is to really think about what I need to overcome, the specifics of the obstacles. The brain doesn't like that for a variety of reasons. We need to train the brain to see problems as obstacles to overcome, not reasons to give up. That's so that order really matters. And then just a brief piece of history, which I find fascinating. There's a guy during the Vietnam War called Major James Stockdale. He was a U.S. Navy pilot during the war. He was shot down over Vietnam, made it out safe, but he ended up being a POW for almost 8 years. And so he served in a Vietnamese POW camp. Horrible experience, obviously. He was tortured, starved. A bunch of his friends were killed. He made it back, though. And in his memoirs, he was asked a question by someone. Someone said, James, you made it back. Who did not make it back? And his answer was really startling. He said, oh, that's easy. The optimists did not make it back. And then he went on to explain, and he calls them the Christmas optimists. These were people in the POW camp, prisoners there, who said, don't worry about it. We'll be out by Christmas. And then Christmas would come, and they wouldn't get out. And then they'd say, oh, don't worry about it. We'll be out by spring. Spring came. They didn't get out. Don't worry about it. We'll be out by fall. So on and so forth. Until, in his own words, he said, eventually they died of a broken heart because they refused to grasp the reality of their current situation. And he reflects on all this about the reason that he found what, he would say led him to get out was he was convinced that he would be rescued. He had that vision, but every single day, his objective was to be present in the reality of it and say, this is my current reality. And this, again, is his personal anecdote on it, but that is the mix, right? We have to be radically present in the negative reality of the situation. So like all of my work when it comes to language is helping people better communicate the reality part of it and the positive part. But the better mm-hmm. that we can communicate the negative allows for the brain, for one, to identify the specificity of it and to react to it. And that lives in tandem with the belief that things can change. And that is the sauce for resilience. It's the sauce for persistence, and it's the sauce for behavior change. So a little bit of a diatribe there, but it's a very,
no,
very important.
This makes so much sense to me because I'm a former tennis player, and I don't know, Rafa Nadal, as everyone knows, he's about to have this documentary come out in a week. The whole tennis world's But he had this unbelievable way of visioning how the match was going to go, whether his foot was hurting or the guy was crushing his, you know, forehand side or backhand side, whatever it was. He would just have the vision, and then he would overcome things. Yeah. That is literally the difference between him, Roger Federer, Novak Djokovic, all these top three guys versus the other guys on tour.
Yeah,
it makes total sense what you're saying. It's just maybe harder to do in practice.
I'll give you one more thing to really cement this. This was the craziest thing that I've discovered in my research when it comes to this topic. And at first it seems counter logical. So most of the time when we think about like having a big ambition, having the evidence to back it up, what we like to do is we like to declare the inevitability of our success. We like to say, I will be successful. I will close this deal. I will bring in three clients. I will bring in revenue. I will win this major, right? We think the internet has really convinced us that that's the effective way, right? Speak it into existence. Use big, loud declarations. And certainly, I think they're valuable. But there's something that we need to append to it, and all the research supports it. So most people say, I will do something. The most effective way to put yourself in a mindset that actually helps you accomplish it is not to say, I will. It's to ask yourself, will I? And that seems totally reverse, right? Like, why would I question my ability to accomplish something? But all the psychology on this says this is the thing that actually puts your brain in that anticipatory mindset, because saying, I will, is a declaration, and it's associated with extrinsic motivation. So when your brain hears, I will, subconsciously, even if it's not a conscious decision, there's resistance to it. The brain doesn't like to be put in a corner and told this is the inevitability. It's associated a lot with extrinsic motivation, which is external pressure, internal expectation, so on and so forth. The idea of will I, an open-ended question like that to your brain, the brain wants to answer it. And if you're the kind of person who is putting in the reps and doing the thing, the answer becomes, for instance, will I be successful? The brain says, will I be successful? Well, yeah, because you're first in the office. You're taking clients out three times a week. You're going above and beyond with this, that, and the other. You're accumulating all this evidence for your brain. That's the thing that actually puts you in the mindset, the anticipatory state versus the I will. I have found a lot of high caliber athletes use both of those things in tandem. Right. So like on Saturday during the major, I will do this, that, and the other. Will I be successful? Well, yes, because here's all the evidence that supports it. You use those two things in tandem, loud declarations. Yes. But then the specificity of the evidence to support that logically, that's the sauce. I do this all the time for senior execs. We get them to write down their goals. We get them to then reframe them in terms of will I, and it becomes a totally different placement in the brain. And then manifest it a little bit differently in how we think about ourselves and behavior. So that's fine. That's what really
timing is so interesting on that. I know you're a Chicago guy, but as a New York Knicks fan, this has been a pretty big week. And, you know, I look at Jalen Brunson, and I've kind of gotten to know him and some of the folks, because we, Jay Wright, does a lot of work with us at UBS, who coached Villanova, had won two championships. And here the Knicks are down 22 points with 7 minutes left. And there is absolutely, you know, a million to one chance they're going to come back and win this game. But you had Brunson, who just, he's an optimist. I mean, he literally said that, I think, in his post game. And it means everything. It means everything. And I love that when you talk a little bit about the history of the Stockdale situation, because I'm a junkie with history. And, you know, it's interesting because I see a little bit of stoicism in what you're talking about. You know, and I guess if there's a Mount Rushmore of that, you know, you've certainly got the Socrates, but you also have Yoda, and you also have Winston Churchill, you know, and you have these people that were facing things that a total junkie on Churchill that just absolutely no way that's going to happen. I mean, there was no way the United States was going to get in that war, but you know, he didn't give up. And I just admire that. And I think that when we talk a little bit more about leadership here, you know, you've built this very meaningful audience through consistency and honesty, honest conversations. But we're living now in a world that's flooded with AI generated content, right? Polished branding. Do you think human connection is actually becoming more valuable, not less?
I think its stock went way up. Certainly, I'm investing fully there. I think a lot of other people are seeing this as well. I mean, my main focus right now is offline. It's analog. So it's in terms of events that I self-host, It's coming into companies and leading workshops and keynotes in person on the advisory side and the angel investing side. I'm pretty much fully invested in offline analog brands, or at least hardware brands for offline. It's increasingly valuable, of course. You know, I always say, like, when I lead these sessions, you know, I say, you know, optimism is amplified in community. There's something powerful, for one, when I lead these sessions and everyone is just focused on, in that moment, generating the energy of optimism. You could literally feel it in the room. And I've done such a wide variety of speaking and workshop engagements. I've done them in nightclubs. I did one recently in Montreal for a pop singer. I opened up in literally a concert hall, getting people to believe this. I've done them all over. And I think the common theme I see time and time again is people will come for me, which is great. But most of the time, they just want to come and meet other people on the same page. They want to just meet other optimists. My fiance is a DJ. We threw a party in Miami right before we left for the summer, and we had like 1,300 RSVPs. I just literally put up a story on Instagram that said, "Hey, I'm going to throw a party. The requirement is, if you're going to come to this, I just want you to be an optimist. Come and join other optimists." And the demand for that just, again, reinforced this idea of offline connection. I'm grateful to have an online presence, but my goal is to get it offline and meet people in person and travel the world and do these things.
But let me ask you also about mindfulness, just because I personally have a fascination with it and struggle a lot with it. Like, you know, I've listened to, you know, so many great people talk about it and say it's okay, especially meditation, that, you know, it's not always going to work and it's going to be different for everybody. And, you know, Dan, forgetting his last name now, does a podcast on meditation from ABC News, is always really talked about that. But how does mindfulness really tie in the leadership world? Because we all have to breathe. We all have to find that time during the day. For some of us, it's meditation. For some of us, it's going out and playing tennis. For me, it's playing the piano. That's where I get my mindfulness. So how does that relate, you know, for the strong leaders of today?
I mean, I would argue that optimism is somewhat impossible without mindfulness. Optimism is impossible without presence, right? So how can you make a decision about change without being in a situation to identify your current circumstance, right? So if change is the difference between current circumstance and a future circumstance, without the current circumstance, there's no wall to push off of. I think about it like being in a swimming pool. You don't start in the middle of the pool and start to swim. You need a wall to push off of. That's the presence. That's the potential negative. That's the friction in your life. That's the thing that you need to identify. So I think, it's, you know, however you think about mindfulness, right? That's one of those things. Is it meditation? Yes, absolutely. Is it just grounding? Absolutely. What is your capacity to identify the current state of your emotions? That's the objective. It's a requirement. Again, to my comment earlier, I think a lot of leaders struggle with that because it's go, go, go. It is a fundamental requirement. Because the idea with optimism is two things, and this is the foundation of so many therapeutic approaches to life, CBT, DBT in particular, the coexistence of two things at once and allowing for that state to not fracture your belief in what's to come. So we have to find a way to basically complete a sentence like follows. Something is true and something else is true. But we need that first half, right? So like, for instance, you know, if we want to believe that we can, or for instance, I when I first started off as an account executive at the company that I worked with in whatever 2013, I was like, yeah, I want to be the top grossing salesperson at this company. But I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have a client base. I didn't have any of the context. So the reality of that situation that I needed to be mindful of was, you know, I want this thing, but right now I don't have any of the skills. I don't have any of the network. Those two things need to coexist. The hack there is, most of us, if we could find ourselves to be mindful, we could voice that. But most of us always use the word but. So we'll say something like, I want to be the top grossing salesperson in my region, but right now, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have the confidence. I don't have the skill set. I don't have the network. We say but. But really destroys that mindfulness. But in linguistics is a contrast term, right? The brain hears but, and then it focuses on what you just said after it. So all the brain then hears is, I don't have the confidence. I don't have the skill set. I don't have the network. The key here that really connects mindfulness with optimism is, we say, I want to be a top-grossing salesperson in my region, and And right now, I don't have enough skill set, confidence, experience. And it's such a catalyzing word for an ambitious leader. And what do you do when you hear the word and? All right, well, let's freaking figure it out. Let's
Yeah,
do it. Let's freaking
that's
do it.
good.
It's a catalyzer, right? So that's how we connect those two things. And that, again, Sammy, to your point, that's why it's essential that we have that element of realism, which comes from presence, which is a core tenet of mindfulness.
So fascinating. I want to shift our conversation a little bit to leadership under pressure, efficiency, and performance. Okay, a lot of our audience here or clients at UBS are entrepreneurs, CEOs, operators, making high-stake decisions every single day. Markets move. A lot of this is energy management just as much as time management. So what have you learned about self-talk, optimism, and mental framing that can actually help leaders make sharper and efficient decisions?
Yeah, quite a few things, certainly. I mean, you know, for one, I mean, I think a leader needs to have good trust in their instincts, right? Not positive, not toxic positivity, not toxic trust that any intuitive thought they have is the right one. Certainly a great leader surrounds himself with people who can offer those contrasting thoughts. And I think that that's a great fodder for optimism to say, I've considered all these things. So will this be successful? Well, I've done all these things. I've done the best I can. So the rest is trust. Actually, it's actually really interesting. A lot of the studies suggest that consideration of future regrets is what allows for you to have more optimism and be more effective. That is to, when you're making a decision, to actively think about what is the potential regret that would come from this. Not only obviously is that a great clarifying exercise, if you can actually kind of think about some of the step two, step threes down the line, but they've shown that generally speaking, when people use regrets as a decision framework, they end up with decisions that are more value aligned, more effective, and most importantly, leave them feeling more hopeful. So I always regret is one of those things that no leader wants to think about, but using that as a compass is really, really powerful. And then, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think a real core tenet of, you know, of a leader, I suppose, is, you know, there's something in psychology called the endowed progress effect, which basically says the brain is more heavily utilized and will support your ambition when it believes that the thing that you want to accomplish is already in motion, right? So it's not like we're starting from scratch. It's, this is already in motion. So it's not a, you know, this thing will be successful. The verbiage is more along the lines of this thing is happening, right? It's not, I hope this will work out. It's this thing is working out. So I think, you know, a good leader is always trial testing these things and accumulating the evidence and building it up over somewhat long periods of time such that they have this thing. They have the belief, they have the regret framework, and they bring that all together. And I think, you know, you've got a magic sauce there. And that's a combination of sitting and contemplating. It's also a combination of, you know, moving tactically. And I, you know, I can't speak to every industry, but I think there's always an opportunity to trial test things in small forms, show the brain that this thing is in motion, and using that to get the clarity for bigger motion, bigger changes, pivots, detours, all these things.
You've said a lot of good things today, but that was gold. The regret as a component. I would have never thought about it that way.
Yeah, regret's a nasty word. Why would we ever want to purposely think about regret in the future sense? But the research supports it. And I think it makes sense too, logically.
Well,
right?
It makes so much sense when you say it. Yeah. Like I said, you said a lot of good things here, but that just stuck out to me. That was great.
So, Kit, One of the ways we like to end the show, and with full apologies to Tim Ferriss, I kind of borrowed this from him, but it's such a great question, his billboard question. And I think it ties in well with the world that we're in. So if you could put one message on a giant billboard that every entrepreneur, founder, leader in the world had to read, okay, every single morning before they're making decisions, what would it say and why?
Yeah, I would say the following, and it's not even original to me, but I don't know who it's original to. I actually found this on Reddit many, many years ago. Reddit's a big piece of inspiration for me because it's normal people with normal life experiences, right? So it's not the gurus, it's not the cases who do this for a living. It's normal people giving advice based upon what they lived. And someone said the following, and it's always stuck with me. So I put it in large red font on a billboard. It says, The difference between a head full of memories and a head full of regret is your ability to forgive yourself. And I think that encompasses a lot of what we just said, right? You know, to be an effective optimist, you have to be grounded in the belief that things can change, that emotions can change, that your effort matters. And if you're tethered to the past and you're unwilling to forgive yourself for a mistake you made, optimism is going to fall flat. So I think a core tenet of this, of mindfulness, of optimism, is your ability to forgive yourself, to learn from the mistake, certainly radically learn, take radical responsibility, but find a way to say, I forgive myself for that. I have faith that my next decision will be better, will be more aligned, will be more informed. And that is what I'm going to trust. So that's what I would say.
And I assume that billboard would be in red ink.
Of course.
Yes. 100%.
Why the red? Let me ask you that. I meant to ask this earlier.
To me, it was pretty simple. I mean, red is a vibrant color. I think a lot of people get a little bit of trauma flashbacks from seventh grade English where they're like, oh, that's great. Yeah. But for me, there's so much noise in life. Red cuts through the color. And a lot of cultures, red is a celebration. I mean, I devoted a lot of time to studying Chinese. Red's a powerful color there. So to me, it grabs the eye, for one. It cuts through the noise. And it's energizing. Optimism, even mindfulness. Sometimes people think, oh, mindfulness is like when you're sad. No, these are a celebration of your emotions so you can catalyze them into a better life. And you write that down in red. All the things we just talked about, by the way, I always encourage people to handwrite these things. There's so much great research around the mind and body, but just the intention of moving left to right and writing these things down. And you do it in red. I find, for one, better recall personally, but two, it's a celebration. It's energizing. It's, hey, look here. There's a lot of noise, but look here. This is the mantra. This is the reminder.
Thank you for joining us on the Leadership Lounge with Mitch Slater and Saman Sami, powered by UBS. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation and gained valuable insights to fuel your own success journey. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and share the episode with anyone looking to grow as a leader. And stay tuned for more exclusive stories and strategies from the world's most inspiring business minds. Until next time, keep leading with purpose.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.